From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. No Impact Man Colin Bevin talks about what's behind his effort to reduce our collective footprint.
The point is not consumerism with the hope that some good will come out of it, but we actually just say, let's do the good things.
Later on the show, why audiences still love the late comedian Groucho Marx, who is channeled on stage at the Milwaukee Rep by actor Frank Ferrante.
He was a surrogate for many of us. He took down politics and politicians, big business, lawyers, doctors, people in power. And that doesn't get old. It's exhilarating to see the little guy beat the big guy.
Plus, we'll catch up with the musical duo Sarah and Kenny, that rare band which splits its time among Milwaukee, Italy, and London. Lake Effect comes your way next after this news from NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Whether it's reusing shopping bags, biking to work, or pouring your coffee into a ceramic mug instead of a styrofoam cup, many of us have considered ways to reduce our personal carbon footprint. But Colin Bevin has considered a lot of them.
The Brooklyn-based writer and blogger funneled his concerns about climate change into action, starting with a year-long attempt to have zero impact on his environment. He chronicled the experiment in a book called No Impact Man, which later became a documentary. Time magazine ranked his online presence among the world's top 15 environmental websites.
Bevin visited Milwaukee last month to share his story at UWM as the university kicked off a week-long effort to waste and consume less.
Lake Effect's Susan Bentz sat down with Bevin, who says he started out neither as an environmentalist nor an activist. For him, it started years ago with concerns about climate change and the Iraq War.
Well, actually what happened was I was angry. I was angry. First of all, I was angry at what we did for oil. Over 3,000 American troops dead, over 100,000 Iraqis dead. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on now, pretty much everybody agrees it was a war for oil to have an American footprint in the Middle East. So I was upset about that. I was upset about climate change, that actually burning of the self-same oil was causing us to degrade the ability of our habitat to support us as a species. And I was upset about the way of life in between, that 27% of Americans at any one time could be diagnosed with depression or major anxiety disorder. So we were like wrecking the place and not having a party doing it. And I wanted to write some sort of a book, you know, chastising it. Don't you realize what you're doing to the world? And one day, a hot summer's day, I was thinking about what book I would write. And I came into my apartment in New York, and it was boiling hot in the corridor of my apartment building. I opened the door to my apartment, and this frigid air came out because I had left both air conditioners on all day long because I didn't want to have to wait 20 minutes for my apartment to cool down. And I had this moment where I thought about that. I thought, if we're in a war for energy, basically, where people are dying for energy, and I'm wasting that energy by just letting my air conditioners run all day long with no one home, what does that say about me? Because people are actually dying for that energy. And in that moment, I had this idea where if I wanted to attract public attention, if I wanted to contribute to that, to climate change and what I call a crisis in our way of life, that maybe I should actually write a story about my changing and my doing something about it instead of a finger-wagging story about how everybody should do it.
So at that point in your life, you were on your own, or did you have a family?
Yeah, I was married to my now co-parent, Michelle, and I had a little girl, Isabella, who was at that time 1.5, and a dog, Frankie. Frankie sadly's passed. Together, I called us 10 legs and a tail.
So you and your partner sat down and set up a framework?
We took 1 month at a time to figure out a different area of our life. So the first month was not buying anything new. If we were going to buy clothes, where would we buy them secondhand? Or buy anything, electronics, where would we buy anything secondhand? So no buying anything new was the first month. We kind of leaned into that and learned how to do it. I remember one time it was my daughter's birthday, and we found this secondhand children's store. We told her, you can have anything you want. And she found this pair of silver slippers. They were $1.50, and that's what she wanted for her birthday in this secondhand store. It was so sweet. The second month was learning how not to make trash. So that meant no buying any food in packaging, no buying anything in packaging. So no yogurt, no milk in a carton. We found a place where we could buy milk in returnable glass bottles where the farmer reused the bottles. Or if we bought cheese, I brought my own cheesecloth to the farmer's market. And meanwhile, still not buying anything new. And then from there to sustainable transportation. No transportation of any kind that used fossil fuels, which meant not even mass transit. Not that I'm against mass transit, but this was an experiment in trying to reduce our impact as much as possible. So only walking and biking, basically. Then the next month was only local food. The next month was sustainable energy use, which meant we actually ended up turning off the electricity in our apartment because there was no way to really get sustainable electricity, sustainable water use, and then giving back. And then once we'd been through those months, then we had 6 months left where we just lived all of it for the remaining 6 months of the year.
So what was toughest?
The toughest was that I ended up having to wash our clothes by hand. What we would do is we would throw the dirty clothes in the bathtub and laundry soap, and we would stomp it. Like, you know, like in the olden, we used to call it Grape Stomper's Laundry Day because it was like as though we were stomping grapes for wine. In fact, in the movie No Impact Man, there's a scene where the three of us, my daughter Isabella and my co-parent Michelle, are stomping the laundry and we're all laughing. So when people say what was the hardest, it's really interesting because we imagine that all our modern conveniences make our lives easier. But actually, there's a law in economics that the more efficient you become, the more efficient you have to be. We don't get a laundry machine and then luxuriate in the free time of not having to wash our clothes by hand. We get a laundry machine, and then we find ourselves working harder during the time we would have been doing our laundry to make the money for the laundry machine. And the same with the microwave, and the same with the electric dishwasher. Everybody says what was harder about living environmentally, but in fact, there were a lot of things that were way better. We got rid of our TV, which meant we spent more time with each other as a family and with our friends. Because of the local food element, we always had a big pot of homemade soup in the fridge. Our friends would come over and eat our good food, and then we'd play charades. Instead of watching TV, we'd relate to each other. We'd spend time with it. When on hot days, when there was no air conditioning, we would go to Washington Square Park, and my daughter Isabella would play in the fountain. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating a return to 19th century living. What I am saying is that as a people, as a society, I think we've lost sight of our human priorities. Like what actually makes our lives good? Because we've gotten to this stage where we're working and working and working to get stuff. We're working for the conveniences that allow us to work, you know. We're on the work-to-spend treadmill. And that same consumerist work-to-spend treadmill, which degrades our own happiness, is degrading our planet's ability to support us. But the part I think that's most important, which I came to embrace during the year, which is that each of us actually makes a difference. Like, we can be engaged in our societies, and I think we're seeing that now in the United States more. People are starting, are beginning to become engaged in their society in a new way, and we can be engaged in both in terms of how we choose to live our lives, you know, that maybe we choose to have the type of life, you know, and hope that our cities will embrace a way of planning the design of the city that allows for active transportation as opposed to requiring us all to have cars. Because let's not forget that actually to own a car costs the average American $12,000 a year. So we're back to working to get the car so that you can get to work, right? Whereas we could have a way of life where we lived near to each other and walked and biked and actually got exercise. Because cars are also, the research shows, responsible for obesity, partly responsible in the United States. But the big thing for me has been that I've realized that I have the power to change my life and the life of others. The lives of others. And you know, I'm here in Wisconsin to give a talk to students, and basically that's what I'll be talking about, how these students also have the power to choose how they want to live their lives, that they do not have to choose to be part of the work to spend treadmill. They can instead choose lives of meaning and purpose, and that they are capable of shaping their lives and shaping the society that they live in a way that's better for all of us.
So not so many years ago, you ran for the House of Representatives. What led to that moment, and would you consider it again?
You know, I just at the moment, the climate movement is finally saying we should be running for office. You know, I just read a tweet by Bill McKibben, actually, where he said, if you're running for office, and you should be, et cetera, et cetera. Back in 2012, I had that thought that we should, activists tend to stand outside the political system and try to push against it rather than actually invading the political system and attempting to subvert it. So I ran in 2012 with absolutely no chance of winning because I ran as a Green Party candidate in something like a 92% Democratic stronghold. There was never a chance that I would win. But because it was a Democratic stronghold, the Democratic candidate didn't spend any time in his constituency talking to his electors. He was around campaigning for other people around the country. In other words, the Democrats just took this area for granted. You know, you have nowhere else to go, so we're not going to pay attention to you. So my run for Congress was actually an attempt to, well, first to model to the climate movement that we could be running for seats and having conversations and expanding the conversation and understanding the connections. And the connection is very clear in my mind because war for oil equals over 50% military budget, means no money for education and housing, means unfair and unequal economic system, and equals climate change. So that actually these connect, which all, for me, connect around, again, the consumer economy, the idea that the way that we do well is by digging resources out of the ground, molding them into a product, hoping that people will buy them, and then throw them away and buy a new version of them as soon as possible, then burying them in another hole in the ground. That actually there's a way of being where instead of thinking health or education or housing is the spin-off of this consumerism, that we actually address ourselves directly to those things and say, the point is not consumerism with the hope that some good will come out of it, but we actually just say, let's do the good things.
So I was going to ask if in your work, if there's an individual or a place or time of somebody embracing or having an aha moment with this no impact or low impact philosophy, but I guess I would shift that to ask, do you feel that you're making headway among people who are not already in some way either concerned, enlightened?
I mean, I think two things to say. First of all, I think everybody's concerned. In another part of my life, I teach meditation. And part of my job as a teacher is that I sit and I do interviews, and consult what we call consulting interviews, where students come in to ask questions about their practice and, you know, maybe talk about some life problems. We talk about how the practice of mindfulness can be used to help with whatever their situation is. And person after person after person is coming in to discuss anxiety. So it's not that people aren't aware or don't think people are, something's wrong. If you go, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you see, if you go and you think, everybody raise your hand who thinks the world and our government is working correctly, nobody raises their hand. Or maybe two or three people who want to be a bit rebellious say so. There's no problem with people seeing that there's a problem. The question is getting some sort of consensus around the nexus or the location of the problem. Well, I'll tell you about a conversation. I was giving a talk in Washington, D.C., and I said, it's ridiculous that we spend 51 weeks a year working our rear ends off so that on the 52nd week of the year, we can take our families to Disney World. And somebody raised her hand and she said, but I like going to Disney World. And I said, well, yes, I understand that. She said, it's the only time I get to spend with my children. And I said, well, I understand that, and I would never take that away from you under the current system, but what if we had a system where you as a mom could actually spend time with your kids during the year? Would you give up Disney World if you could spend, you know, 20 hours a week with your kids every week? And she was like, more or less, you're trying to take Disney World away. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not trying to take, I'm trying to see if I can offer you something better. She argued with me for a little while, and then finally I said, for some reason, we're not connecting. And so I said to her, I said, I think, you know, I have to leave it to you that you prefer 1 week in Disney World and I prefer 51 weeks, you know, 52 weeks with my kids. And she said, wait, you're saying during the year we spend time with our kids and we don't just spend time with 1 week? And I said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. She said, oh, she said, I agree with you. But the idea that we could live differently was so such a stretch of imagination from her, because she had worked so hard in her life to give her children just to scratch out that 1 week a year. Like that imagining that we could actually not be working our rear ends off in that way, that we could return to our human values, is a stretch for people. So sometimes it's hard to get people to agree because it's beyond their imagining, right? The second thing I'll say on your point is that in terms of social change, we don't have to get everybody to agree with us. All we really have to do, and there's enough, I believe, there's enough people who actually agree with us. All we really have to do is convince the people who agree with us that they make a difference, that they'll make a change if they get involved.
Environmental writer Colin Bevan speaking with Lake Effect Susan Bentz in April. As you would expect, Bevan flew in from New York for his appearance in Milwaukee, but he told Lake Effect Susan Bentz he has maintained pieces of his year-long attempt at zero waste. You'll find more about his work at WUWM.com.
We'll take just a quick break now and then a conversation with Groucho Marx or a reasonable facsimile thereof. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. The great comedian Groucho Marx has been gone for nearly 40 years, but his comic legacy lives on. You can still watch classic Marx Brothers movies such as Duck Soup and Animal Crackers, or his long-running game show You Bet Your Life on TV or YouTube. And you can still feel his influence in the work of many comedians, from Stephen Wright to Jerry Seinfeld and countless others.
The Groucho legacy also lives on through the persona of actor Frank Ferrante, who was hand-chosen to play the role of Groucho Marx years ago by none other than Groucho's son. Ferrante has channeled Groucho for more than three decades now, the last couple of months of which have been spent in Milwaukee, putting on the one, or really one-and-a-half-man show at the Milwaukee Rep called An Evening with Groucho. Frank Ferrante joined us as the show was getting ready to open back in March. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch. Appreciate it.
So Groucho Marx is this iconic character in American show business, American comedy. Can you give us some perspective on why or maybe how his influence is still being felt today? Why are we still talking about Groucho Marx in 2017?
It's a great question, and I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that he was so funny. I mean, people say, why are we still laughing at Groucho Marx? He was, and I think it was so funny because he was born that way, and we also trained from the time he was a boy in performance. He was on the road when he was 15 years old, when he was a kid in the Upper East Side of New York. His uncle was a vaudevillian by the name of Al Sheen of Gallagher and Sheen, and they were a famous vaudeville duo. Oh, Mr. Gallagher, oh, Mr. Gallagher, what's on your mind this morning, Mr. Sheen? Absolutely, Mr. Gallagher, positively, Mr. Sheen. So they had this patter song, Gallagher and Sheen, and there was a lot of wordplay, and they made fun of what was going on and topically, what was happening and politically, socially. And so Groucho Marx and his brothers, who were basically poor kids growing up in New York, absorbed a lot of show business. Their mother, Groucho's mother, was a relentless stage mother, Minnie Marx, and pushed him on the stage when he was 15. He once said, "My mother treated all of us boys equally with contempt." but she was determined to see Groucho and the other four boys succeed like her brother had, Al Sheen. And they had a grandfather who was a ventriloquist, a grandmother who was a harpist. So what I'm saying is it was in the DNA. But then Groucho spent 25 years with his brothers on the road playing all kinds of towns, like Milwaukee, honing their comic personalities. I think we love Groucho because he speaks on our behalf. I fell in love with Groucho Marx when I was 9 years old, and I saw A Day at the Races. Neighborhood kids said, "Frank, put on the TV and check these guys out." And there was Groucho with his grease paint mustache, the eyebrows, the crazy hair, and he was the loping walk, the cigar. And he was saying outrageous things. Some of those things at 9, 10, I did not understand. But I knew he was being irreverent, and he was being free, and he was being outrageous. And the behavior was completely inappropriate, which I loved.
Especially when you're 9 or 10.
When you're 9. And I was a shy kid, and I was taught by nuns. And I think I wanted to behave the way Groucho did within that classroom that I was in. And that's really what it was for me. So And I think he had he was self-taught, Groucho. Groucho kept a dictionary. Groucho's son, Arthur Marx, hired me right out of college to play his father.
Right, and I want to ask you about that because you were kind of identified on as not just somebody who was interested, but somebody who could kind of – who could do this.
Right, and that was really the family that took me there. It took me on that ride. But this is a roundabout way to answer your question, Mitch, but there were so many things why. I think Groucho Marx – he was a surrogate for many of us. He took down politics and politicians, big business, lawyers, doctors, people in power. And that doesn't get old. It's exhilarating to see the little guy beat the big guy. And I think that's more relevant now than ever. He's going through a resurgence right now. The Marx Brothers movies, the first five Paramount films, Coconuts, Duck Soup, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, Animal Crackers, they've all been remastered and put on Blu-ray. Half a dozen books have come out on Groucho Marx in the last year. So there's an interest, and you always – why is the great question. I think people want to laugh. I think Groucho was great at making us laugh. He was a master at it, and he taps into something with us. And maybe it's that the fact that he was so fearless in his persona that he said what we wanted to say and did what we wanted to do. And I really think that's maybe at the core. And also he did it so beautifully. He got away with it.
Right. It's interesting. There's a book out there, and I can't remember the exact title, but it's basically an encyclopedia of the formerly funny things that, you know, in their time were funny that we look at them and say, how is this funny? And when you look at Groucho Marx, it is still his material, his delivery, his content. It is all still, empirically speaking, funny.
I agree. What a perfect line this was, written for him in 1928. And the wordplay was at the core of his character. One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How we got in my pajamas, I don't know. Right there, it surprises you. And now that joke's been said 1,000 times and was groaned at back in 1928. And still gets a laugh in 2017. A lot of the puns. He plays an African explorer in Animal Crackers, and one of the puns is, then we tried to remove the tusks. Tusks, that's not so easy to say. You try that sometime. And we tried to remove the tusks, but they were so firmly embedded that we couldn't budge them. Of course, in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa. Now, I read reviews. Now, that pun, Tuscaloosa, right, got groans back in 1928. It gets the same reaction in 2017. But there's a currency to Groucho Marx. It doesn't feel old-fashioned. I've listened to hours and hours of his radio show, You Bet Your Life. He could work today. He had a brilliant mind, and he exhilarates. When I saw him in A Day at the Races as a boy, I thought, I want to do this. I'm exhilarated. I remember just being adrenalized and high from watching the Marx Brothers. And I've met a lot of my peers who feel the same way about – I guess you can say that about any great art. And I don't know if he saw himself as an artist, but he was certainly a great one and a transcendent one, or we wouldn't be speaking about him in 2017 necessarily. But there was something about him that exhilarated. And that's really my goal when I do the show, when I perform an evening with Groucho. I want to exhilarate an audience. And I want to surprise the audience. We don't know what Groucho Marx is thinking or what's he going to do. What's he going to do next? What physical gesture or a pratfall is he going to do? What's he going to say? Who's he going to get it? There's a real surprise element to his character. And when I do the show, I don't know what I'm going to do from night to night. My pianist, Gerald Sternbach, doesn't know. And the audience doesn't know. I think that's why people come back time and time again to see the show. I just did the show in Philadelphia, and someone said, I've seen the show 11 times. I was in Seattle. I've seen the show 5 times, because every show is different. And that also, I think, gets to the crux of why is Groucho Marx still with us. They only made 13 films, Mitch, with his brothers, but he'd spent 14 years on television. And in a way, Groucho Marx never left us. He's been with us for over 100 years. We still talk about him. We still write about him. We still honor him. My show still travels. We read about him. Feature stories are written about him all the time. Every great comedian today would probably tip their hat to Groucho Marx, from Ricky Gervais to Louis C.K. Anyone who's working in stand-up, and Jerry Seinfeld has said that, the greatest was the Marx Brothers, were the Marx Brothers.
Well, right, and I think you've stolen all my questions.
I had a cup of coffee before I came in here. Sorry, just wind me up, Mitch, and I'll go. So.
Well, first of all, it's interesting, as I grew up and started to appreciate the bulk of Groucho's work, it was quite the revelation to me that all those lines I heard my grandfather tell me were not originals.
Right, right, right.
especially the Tuscaloosa right. one. Is there a difference to you between channeling and interpreting?
Well, I feel like I attempt both within this piece. I've done the role 32 years since I was 22 years old. I've done this part, and I've done it probably more than 3,000 times in over 500 cities. I just got back from Australia with a two-month tour. So it's really in my bones. It's in my bones. It's in my blood, this role. And I'm very close to his family. His son, Arthur, I said, hi, you know, cast me to play his father. And that's, I mean, as a boy, that's why I was 22 years old. And the son of my hero, comic hero, deemed me worthy to portray his father, perhaps the funniest man the country's produced. Interpretation to me means I'm filtering it through my own skill set, through my own experience as an actor and a director and as a person of the theater. So I'm certainly doing that. I mean, if you want to see Groucho Marx, you should go download Duck Soup or Night at the Opera, watch reruns of reruns. No one does reruns, but watch You Bet Your Life, his TV show in which he basically kibitz. He just dialogues with so-called everyday folk to, you know, hilarious, you know, results. But channeling, sometimes I feel like that I tap into a spirit, and that's really, this is that kind of role. I want people to get a sense of what it may have been like to experience Groucho Marx in his prime in 1934, if he ever had a one-man show, which he never did because he always worked with his brothers in those 1930s. This is the show I'm doing at Milwaukee Rep, and it's a very intimate space, the Stackner, so you feel like you're in Groucho Marx's study or his living room. But to answer your question, there's certainly interpretation involved. It's the way it's my fantasy of Groucho Marx as a boy sitting at his feet, what I would want from this man. And the channeling is something that comes from, I think, really being in tune with him and his life and his loves, his family, his interests, and opening up, you know, as an actor and letting him in and just sharing him. And honestly, it's also repetition. The more I do it, I'd like to think the better I get. And I played this role in every region in the country and all over. And you absorb it. And you hope that the audience forgets. The best compliment I got was just a couple weeks ago. An acting peer of mine said, Frank, I've known you for 20 years. I've seen you do this before. I forget it's you. And that, to me, what's better than that? And that's why I try to get Frank Ferranti needs to leave the building, and the essence of Groucho needs to take over. And I want an audience to get a sense of his spirit. There may be people who are more, maybe even more technically better at doing this, but I don't know if anyone has had the kind of time with a character like I've had, with the exception of Hal Holbrook and Mark Twain tonight, who's a friend of mine. He's done his show for almost 65 years. And he was one of those guys, Mitch, that whose show, when I was a teenager, I saw his show because I was putting together a one-man show as a senior project at USC where Arthur Marx saw me. And 2 years ago, we became friends when he saw my show. And I had him sign my poster back when I saw him as a 19-year-old. And he signed that same poster again just a couple of years ago.
Does he sign it as Hal Holbrook or Mark Twain?
He signs it as Hal Holbrook, yeah. But boy, he's 92 years old. He's still working. And I'd like to be able to do this show for another 30 years, quite frankly. But, you know, speaking of sitting at Groucho's feet, I did get to see Groucho Marx when he was an old man. And
What setting did you see him?
He was promoting a book at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles called The Groucho File. And he was just short of his 86th birthday, and he was not well. He'd had a couple of strokes. And it's been well reported. His life was making headlines as he started to diminish in his health wise. Everyone loved Groucho, wanted him to stay alive, and he had lots of fans, millions. And my father took the day off of work. I took the day off of school, and my father took me to see my hero. It's a beautiful thing. The more I think about it, the more I'm moved by the fact that my father did this. And we go to the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, and Groucho's supposed to be there to promote the book. No Groucho. 3 hours past, no Groucho. He finally shows up. And there's this tiny little man with a beret and thick glasses. He shows up, and I follow Groucho Marx to the podium. I sit at his feet, and there are 1,000 people in this room waiting for Groucho Marx to be funny. And I'm looking up, and there he is. and he mumbles through the first part of this presentation. Can you hear me out there? Can you hear me out there? I thought he was a man. We all waited for a joke. Like, you're not missing anything. Well, he didn't do any of that. So we're going, oh, my gosh. He looked like he was going to keel over. And he was glassy-eyed. There he was. And finally, someone asked a question. Groucho, are you making any new Marx Brothers movies? He took a long pause and said, no, I'm answering stupid questions. And 1,000 people erupted. And so the body was shot, but the mind was still there. And then a woman said, Groucho, what do you dream about? He took another long pause and looked at her and said, not you. And again, we want him to be irreverent and rude and brash and do what we cannot do in any given social setting. And it was great. And then he deflated at the end of the session, and he walked to his car, and I followed him to his car, his town car. And I have a photo with him. I was 13 years old. And he drove off into the sun, walked off into the sunset, this great lion of comedy. And it stayed with me. When I did the show that Arthur Marx hired me for back in the mid-'80s, I did it in New York and in the off-Broadway and in London and the West End. The very last moment of I played Groucho from age 15 to 85. The very last moment of that play is me as old Groucho turning my back, hello, I must be going. I sing a song, and I turn away, and I'm in silhouette and in the beret, and then we're in a pin spot, and it goes to black. And so there, 10 years later, I was playing Groucho Marx as an 85-year-old, having seen him the 10 years prior. So there's a lot of beautiful things. There's been a lot of signs in my life in terms of, Frank, you should be involved in the comic arts. And I do other things. I direct plays and work in regional theater, but this is a role that keeps coming back to me, thankfully, and an opportunity like I have in Milwaukee. I've got 9 weeks to continue to evolve the piece and still figure out bits after all these years. It's wonderful.
And I guess that's a good note to end on, but I have one more question, so I'm going to ask it anyway. You talk about how he never did a one-man show because he was always working with his brothers or basically playing off of the guests on his other shows. When you approach a show like this, do you have to look at the people in the audience as other characters?
It's a great question. The answer is yes. I have the advantage of hindsight over Groucho's whole career. The show is, he was energetic. So I'm jumping over couches. I'm jumping off the stage. It's physical. He loved to sing. So there are funny songs like Lydia the Tattooed Lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Songs like Hooray for Captain Spaulding, the African Explorer. So about 8 of those are in the show, Mitch. And then there's storytelling. Talk about his brothers, Chico, Harpo, Zeppo, Gummo. I talk about his peers, Charlie Chaplin, W.C. Fields. I talk about his famous foil, Margaret Dumont, who embodied, high society and the establishment. I can see you right now in the kitchen bending over a hot stove, but I can't see the stove. These are the kind of lines. This is his idea of lovemaking. But to get back to your question, the interaction with the audience has become part and parcel to the show. It sets it apart from, I think, a lot of shows that may be out there in the solo form. Yes, and I've gotten good over the last 30-something years in terms of picking people. I won't pick some and talk to someone who looks like they don't want to be played with. I will interact with someone who seems game to do it. But they are a character in the show. And so it's me, and it's the audience, and it's my pianist, Gerald Sternbach, who will be playing the show. He was Mel Brooks's accompanist recently in Carrie Fisher's in a one-woman show. So a lot of show business on that stage. But the audience, most of the audience knows they're in for a fun evening. I'm not happy until the audience is whipped up into a frenzy of laughter. It's like, I won't be satisfied. So, and I like seeing all ages. It's interesting what I'm seeing more and more is that the 20-something crowd is showing up. So there's hope.
I think there's a lot of hope.
And Crosby, as they'd say, as Groucho would say.
Frank Ferrante, thank you so much for sharing Groucho with us, and best of luck in the next 9 weeks.
Thank you, Mitch. Hello, I must be going.
Hello, I must be going. I cannot stay. I came to say I must be going. I'm glad I came, but just the same, I must be going.
Frank Ferrante stars as Groucho Marx in the Milwaukee Reps production of An Evening with Groucho, which is on stage at the Stackner Cabaret through the end of May. You can see pictures and read more about it at WUWM.com. We first spoke with him in March as the show was getting ready to open.
One more break, and then we'll catch up with the music duo called Sarah and Kenny and hear a few tunes they played in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Oblige us and tell us of your deeds so glowing.
I'll do anything you say. In fact, I'll even stay.
Good.
But I must be going.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Years of flirting.
We introduced you last year to the musical duo of Sarah and Kenny. It is the unlikely pairing of a classical guitarist from Italy with a classical pianist from Brookfield.
The result is not classical music, though. Rather, it's a laid-back, distinctive collaboration that draws on both of their strengths and creates a sound that is their own. Plenty has happened in both the personal and professional lives of the two of them since last year, including a new album called Familiar Rhythms. They'll play a couple of concerts this week in the Milwaukee area.
But first, they joined Lake Effect Bonnie North in the studio and shared a few songs, including this one called Pictures of a New Life.
Sarah and Kenny in Lake Effect's Performance Studio back again. It's so great to see you both.
Good to see you,
good to see you too.
Thank you. What a great tune.
Thank you.
From the new album?
Yes.
Well, before we get to the new album, we have to kind of back up because so much has changed for you since the last time you sat in these chairs in this studio playing music for me. Mm-hmm. What's going on? Fill me in.
Oh, boy. So that was like a year and a half ago, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So we spent last summer in Italy. We were there for 3 months, and since then we've been living in London.
So even more change.
Yeah.
And so how has that been, being in London and working there?
I'll let you go for this one.
So. Oh, wow. Putting me on the spot. Well, London has been an incredible experience for many reasons. One is the pace of the city. So this is the big city life. And then it's been fun to perform to new audience spaces, you know, that where people don't necessarily know who we are. So it's been fun to put ourselves, you know, in different settings, different musical settings, getting to know new musicians, new scenes, it's been a lot of things.
Yeah, I think it's been really fascinating for us because it's such a culturally diverse city, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially where we live, you know, you walk down the street and you hear like 10, 15 languages every day.
Mm-hmm. Where are you?
We're in like east, right on the verge of zone one, zone two.
Mm-hmm.
The neighborhood's called Shoreditch. But kind of like what Sarah is saying, I mean, there's literally hundreds of concerts a night in London. We've played several times a week, almost every week we've been there, and still discovering new venues, mm-hmm. new places we never knew existed.
And how are people responding to your music?
People are great. The general thing we've found is that there's a huge appreciation for, well, original music and then acoustic music. It's kind of interesting because we feel like in the U.S., people might not be listening quietly to the music, but then are more prone to buy albums, mm-hmm. whereas in London, people listen very quietly, but then don't buy albums.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's been quite an interesting experience playing to like 50 people, 75 people who are silently like staring at you for your entire concert and then get up and leave. You know, yeah. At the end, like that's it. It's like, wow, like, all right, that's different, you know.
And how did that compare to Italy?
Well, Italy was like paradise for me. I mean, eating the best food, meeting new people, trying to speak to people that I'm not even really sure what I'm saying at the time. But no, I think
one of the sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I think one of the craziest things we've done is, so we had this concert and it was summer, so it was really hot. It was a last minute show.
On the stairs?
Yeah, and we were playing like on top of like these stairs outside, but the show didn't start until midnight, and they were pushing it back and pushing it back because apparently people don't go out until 11:45.
Well, you knew that. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that it was that late. Yeah. I've been gone for too long.
I was
going
to say, that sounds like Spain.
Right?
Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah, exactly. You don't have dinner until 11, and so you're not out until 1, kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly.
It's cooler.
I think it's
more comfortable for people.
For sure.
But when you're not on that schedule from here, say, it's really hard to adjust to that.
It was something.
I think that's been one of actually our favorite things living in London, though, is because all the trains shut down around midnight. Like everything
London
closes
is done
at like 11:30 midnight, so like your concert's like 8 to 10. That's it, you know. So you can like be a musician and have somewhat of a normal life.
Wow, actually, you get up in the morning and be able to do things and not feel like you're dragging around.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how has being in both places and now back here, how is that changing your music? Do you find all of that is seeping into the stuff that you're writing?
Oh, definitely.
I think so. You know. Obviously, just throwing yourself in a new situation, you have new sensory experiences, you have new things, it expands your awareness, I think. And, you know, having done these adventures, even in Italy, we traveled around quite a bit and went to a lot of places that you hadn't even been to before. And, like, seeing these new things, definitely, we wrote a lot of music. And being in London, when you're surrounded by so many musicians in general and so many creative people, you know, you're constantly being bombarded with ideas, like, which is really cool. It's just the pace of the way the ideas flow is incredibly fast. But I think it's good also to come back here because there's a good balance, you know, coming back. There's no place like home, obviously, but like having also time to digest that. We're finding we have a little more time here, which has been really nice to be able to kind of process everything that's happened. Because sometimes when you're constantly being bombarded with information all the time, you don't really have the time to sit back and reflect on, you know, what's happened. So
are you back permanently, or is this just a temporary thing and you're going back to London?
We are here for till the end of May. So we're on this long tour. Actually, we started here. Was it already almost 2 weeks ago?
Yeah,
probably. And we're gonna go till the end of July. So we're here till the end of May. Then we're going to back to London for a week, then we start in Germany, then probably back to Italy, and then we're back here at the end of July because we're getting married in August.
Oh, congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's terrific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So you're not going to play at your own wedding, though?
No,
or are you?
No, we don't know.
Probably not. It'd be cheaper. I mean, you
wouldn't have to pay musicians.
Yeah, exactly. Be like, you know what, guys, we got this.
Yeah, we're cool. Yeah, just have the priest come over here, you know. Yeah.
That would be funny.
It would be funny. You should do that as a joke and just see how people react.
Yeah.
But no, that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a terrific thing. And so is the idea, though, once you're married, you'll go back to London? Is London home right now? Or?
Well, we have some shows booked in Germany in September. So
the answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not really sure, but I think we're kind of liking going back and forth. You know, it's because when you're there, you're really far from home. But then, you know, it's good to come back. And we've been finding a lot of enjoyment in, you know, having the time to travel and do these things.
And have all those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, of course, feeds back into the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of music, I want to hear another tune. Mm. Is Alrighty. This also a new one?
Yes.
So tell me about it.
This song's called Never Wanted. And we actually started writing this song last year when we were driving down to New Orleans. We took a road trip and we drove down to New Orleans, and Sarah started banging on the dashboard of my car.
It's lightly tapping.
Which in Italian means banging on the dashboard of your car. And and she's like, you know, I have this rhythmic idea and I kind of have this melody. And like we started putting the words to it. And actually we had basically this like drums and a cappella song. And then much later, we ended up writing all the music to it and kind of arranged it in a way that felt more natural to, I guess, us. And yeah, So,
okay, well, let's hear it. Sara and Kenny in Lake Effect's performance studio with Never Wanted.
Never wanted to be hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound. Never wanted to be hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound. Never wanted disillusion running through my veins. Never wanted expectation pulling on my chains. Never wanted disillusion running through my veins. Never wanted expectation pulling on my chains. Hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound. Never wanted to be hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound. Never wanted disillusion running through my veins. Never wanted expectation pulling on my chains. Never wanted disillusion running through my veins. Never wanted expectation pulling on my chains. To be selfless cause I changed my mind. Never want to be relentless cause I got no time. Never wanted to be selfless cause I changed my mind. Never want to be relentless cause I got no time. Never wanted to get stuck and think it's all the same. And go on and take for granted growth is too untamed. Never wanted to get stuck and think it's all the same. And go on and take for granted growth is too untamed. Hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound. Never wanted to be hiding 6 feet underground. Never wanted to be singing till there is no sound.
Sara and Kenny in Lake Effect's performance studio with Never Wanted. Wow, how many different rhythmic things were going on when you were singing. I was trying to pick one to follow. That must be difficult to sing because you're singing against yourself.
I don't know. I just follow her. I let her do all the heavy
That's
lifting. I just kind of dance on top.
True. We love the idea of, I guess, like the more we go forward, the more we're starting to treat the voices as instruments too, right? And then we've always loved polyrhythms and I wish I could be a drummer. I'm not that coordinated. So then we love introducing all of those things, and especially because they have roots in like traditional music, folk music.
We don't spend too much time thinking about it, but when I reflect on I once did a master class I attended a master class at NYU, and it was fascinating because it was a piano player, and he was talking, you know, obviously having two hands and singing. His whole concept with rhythm was that you need to be able to feel it if you want to express it. So what he would do is he would be tapping two separate rhythms with his left hand and one with his right hand, and the whole objective was to be able to have a conversation with someone and subconsciously be doing that, mm-hmm. you know, which is very deep, and I mean, I think it's a never-ending study. It's not like mm-hmm. you can ever get too good at doing that. And I'm not saying that we're good at doing that, but I'm just saying, you know, it's interesting doing this as a duo because in a lot of ways it can sometimes feel very restricting. But then in a lot of ways it's also very liberating in terms of like, well, what can we actually do with two guitars or two instruments and two voices? I mean, we could, I guess, have up to four rhythms or more if, you know, we were able to do other things with the instruments happening at the same time. And
you could add your feet.
Yeah, yeah. And how can we take advantage of this mm-hmm. To make it not sound empty, you know, to kind of take advantage of the space that we're working with and kind mm-hmm. of really try to utilize what we have.
Sari, you just picked up a very cool little instrument. What
yes,
is that?
This is a ukulele. This is the, we call it the baby.
The baby guitar.
The baby guitar.
It really is. It's got the same sound holes.
Yes, it's the same maker. So this is the same mm-hmm. maker. This started as a joke, and then the uke has like so many sound possibilities. And besides, I've noticed that it's becoming more and more popular. But I think it's almost like going back to, you know, the first guitar had four strings, and it was back in like the 1400s, and it was used to accompany poetry, right? And I feel like the uke has turned into this thing again. Like it's allowing people to express themselves with it in a much simpler way. I find it fascinating because you have less to work with. So it has to feel simpler, but at the same time, you absolutely have to love what you're doing. So it's a fun combination where it forces you almost to not take yourself too seriously. But at the same time, then some deep things happened, because when I first took it, the song Familiar Rhythms came about, and it was very fascinating for me to find out that I just wrote something that sounded like my traditional folk music in Southern Italy. I was like, wow, the uke did that, you know? Because I've never done anything like that on guitar.
Well, I just love having you back in the studio.
Yeah,
thank you. It's so nice to hear what your adventures have led to you two so far. And, you know, I hope you'll come back in another year or two and fill us in on what the next things are, play us some more music. But let's hear this one that was uke inspired. And so did this come from that time when you were camping?
Yep. It happened almost by itself. I love it when some songs happen like that. And then we wrote all the music together after, you know, the camping trip. And then also the words came about. It's funny because today I feel inspired to say something about it. But usually we tend not to say what the songs are about lyric-wise because we don't want to take away from the listener's experience. But in this one, there is something that we're doing that is that has to do with the traditional music. So there's the song says like sing or dance, and it's because the traditional music also invites people to do things. And then the tarantella,
which is her traditional music, the tarantella,
is a dance that's supposed to take your pain out. So it's the legend is that you get bit by a tarantula and you have to dance the poison out. But that poison could be grief or any other difficult thing or moment that you might go through. So then the song has these elements into it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before you get started, Sara and Kenny, thank you so much for coming
you.
In
yeah,
and playing for
us.
And best of luck. And again, congratulations on the upcoming marriage.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vanny. This is Familiar Rhythms.
Sara and Kenny playing in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Their new album is called Familiar Rhythms, and they spoke with Bonnie North. Our in-studio performance was engineered by John Strelecki.
Sara and Kenny have a couple of shows coming up this week, including Friday night at Company Brewing. You'll find their full tour schedule and much more at WUWM.com. And that's it for Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.
To the people you love made to you. Lie, 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 lie.